The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I got to have Fred Willard play my dad, you know, and he actually looks like my dad in real life. So it's just sort of like...
Who looks like Ron Burgundy.
Yeah. He looks like Ron Burgundy and Fred Willard. Yeah, you're like, Kyle, your dad looks like too many people. he also, weirdly, and he was talking about Steve, he kind of looks like Steve Martin too. Hi, I'm Kyle Bornheimer. And when I was 5 years old, I made people call me Steve Martin for an entire year.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of Off the Beat. As always, I'm your host, Brian Baumgartner, and that was Kyle Bornheimer you just heard from. Today, we're going back to our roots a little bit. Those of you who have listened to this podcast for a while know that before we branched off into Off the Beat, we were telling the story of a little show called The Office. And I actually met Kyle while filming The Office. He was on season 4, episode 9, Local Ad, as ad man. But before he was our ad man, he was an ad man. Yes, there was a time in his life when he was the funny commercial guy. But now you probably know him from playing Doug on Avenue 5, being Teddy Wells in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, or as Sam Briggs in Worst Week. Beyond that, Kyle has guest starred in just about every great show from the last few decades, so much so that he seems to be a part of some writer's room jokes. But look, we're going to get into that. In fact, let's get into it right now. Let's bring him on to tell us all about it. Kyle Bornheimer, everyone.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
What's up, Kyle?
Hey!
How are you?
I am very, very good, even better now that I'm seeing you there.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. When do you stop saying Happy New Year?
Maybe today. What's today? Is today the 31st?
Oh, that's right.
I would say today. I don't mind a late January Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Especially if you haven't seen it. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I think, you know, you have all the whole month to launch into your new year. After January 31st, though, then I think it's an awful.
It's on to Groundhog's Day.
Yeah. Happy Groundhog Day.
It's very good to see you. I have so many things that, one, I have learned about you and rediscovered about you, including our brief time together on The Office, actually. But I want to start back. Your story seems fascinating to me. Well, first off, you grew up in Indiana.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is not fascinating.
No,
but
no, it's the opposite. Indiana literally means not fascinating. Yeah.
That's the definition of Indiana? No, that's not true. Well, it's funny because I understand Indiana is not Kansas, but there was a period of time here that I felt like everyone I talked to was like, yeah, I'm from Kansas. And people think, oh, you've got to be from New York or LA or a coast or something. And it was like, yeah, I'm in Kansas and I wanted to get into comedy. It's like, oh.
Well, I think, I mean, anyone living in, by the way, Indiana, I kid, but first of all, it is very fascinating. Hey, looking back on it, and I just took my kids there for the first time, they were legit fascinated by it. And charmed, and love hearing stories, especially them growing up in LA and hearing my stories about growing up in the 70s and 80s and 90s in Mishawaka, Indiana, is incredibly exotic and fascinating to them. By the way, they're probably going to think LA is boring and can't wait to get out of LA or something. Right. I think wherever you grow up, you sometimes will tend to think less of it for a while. But then you get older, you look back, and I really obviously cherish my upbringing there, and was really neat to see it through their eyes this past fall. We went.
So it sounds to me you grew up in Indiana as an old soul. I'm told that you were a really big Singin' in the Rain fan.
Oh my gosh, that's my favorite movie. This is a French poster for Singin' in the Rain right there.
A French poster for Singing in the Rain.
My friend got that for me, actually, because I nonstop talk about that movie. And that's kind of beautiful. It literally, since when you can carry forward. I mean, do you have anything like that? Either people you were fans of, or movies, or music that when you were five, it's the same as when you're 45.
I mean, I think for me, it was The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
but that feels like a cliche. I don't remember.
That's up there for me too. Yeah,
I don't remember thinking or knowing anyone as a kid who was a fan of Singing in the Rain. What was it about that? Was it the singing, the dancing,
the singing and the rain? It was both the singing and the rain. You know, it's funny you say that. Not knowing any kids, there's a family lore that I made all my 6-year-old friends at my birthday party watch Singin' in the Rain. Like, we were outside doing a bunch of fun stuff, and then I was like, okay, now it's time to go in and watch this 30-year-old movie with singing and dancing, and I can tell you all about what I know about Gene Kelly. So I definitely, my family, it was on all the time. I had pretty good movie buffy. Grandparents and parents weren't necessarily movie buffs, but they had very good taste, and they had robust movie collections all the time. Both my mom on my mom's side, her dad, and then my dad loved movies. And like I said, he wasn't like a movie buffy thing where he couldn't like pull out any trivia. He just loved movies, and they happened to have like some pretty good taste in terms of that mainstream. And that one was just one that very early on spoke to me. I remember my brother's was Some Like It Hot. That was the one that he glommed onto as a kid. Wizard of Oz obviously was omnipresent in our whole household. So we've watched that. That's remained pretty amazing. But I think, and then whatever, it just sort of became a staple at our house, and I really and continued loving. And whenever I revisit it, it is legitimately still an amazingly made movie. Like, it is, for some reason, of those that era of musicals, when they were done, all the time, it does stand out as a really, it's an amazing satire on Hollywood. It's just a very tight script. The musical numbers are beautiful. They're very athletic dance numbers that Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly do. I just showed my kids, I mean, they've seen it before, but we just rewatched like the Donald O'Connor Make Them Laugh sequence. And just they were talking about, oh my God, it's like Jim Carrey. It's like, it really is that physical comedy that probably I also like the athleticism and the sort of dynamicism of it as well.
Did you sing and dance and act it out, or was this just?
Oh, I probably did. You know what's really funny? When I moved to LA without any, first of all, not to be an actor at all.
Right.
I moved out to want to be a writer director.
This is what I hear.
But on my to-do list, for whatever reason, was take tap dancing lessons. This was because of my love of Gene Kelly. Now, I had not had any drama, musical, any, really any arts education at all at this time in my life. But for whatever, that was my list. And I did so. And I bought tap shoes. I took, you know, a week's worth of lessons. I fell off of my routine in my practice, and I just sort of fell, and I had no money to be taking tap dancing lessons, the most impractical thing I could be doing at the time. So, but I kept the tap shoes, and I remember when I was first dating my now wife in my tiny little apartment on Doheny, she came over and I was like getting ready before we were going out, and she's like, what's this? And she had found my tap dancing shoes in my closet, and I had to explain to her, well, you've just started dating a man that wanted to be a tap dancer at one point. And I really wish I would have to this day, I still think, well, you know, now I'm heading into the next phase of my life, and maybe I can get that tap dancing thing going again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're gonna talk about your move to LA, but I also was told this, that there was a time in your life, now I don't know exactly when this was, that you, where you made people call you Steve Martin.
Well, yeah, he would be the other thing. You know, I said Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
That since I was five, I've been a fan of, and it's never wavered. And that fandom has been validated by the fact that he is indeed a genius, you know?
Yes.
So I did. And that came directly from, I loved the King Tut bit. So that was probably mostly when I was little from his Saturday Live appearances and probably stand up. And then this was the era. Did your family do this? This was comedy albums where your parents would buy a comedy album and play it in the living room after dinner. And it was Steve Martin and Richard. We probably didn't do Richard Pryor till we were older, but it was that age. So I'm sure we had an album. But I think it was mainly from Saturday Live skits, which, by the way, were not on like YouTube the next day. So I must have been up. You know, my parents must have been letting me stay up. Or right. Maybe there's like a news feature on it or something. And I saw it and I fell in love with him. And then once I was a little older and watching all his movies, The Jerk and everything, just sort of continued that. But I think that was early. I think that was late 70s. I was born in 75. I was probably doing that when I was 5 years old, like 80. And so it must have been from his Saturday Live and like maybe a lot of his Johnny Carson appearances too, because that would have been earlier in the day, like 10:30
right.
maybe.
Yeah. Right. So you go to Purdue, and at this point, you think you're going to do what with your life?
Well, it's journalism, maybe. I was okay. Big. I was already falling in love with movies and this was the 90s. The important part of this is this was the rise of Tarantino and Jane Campion and Rodriguez and all the film and Kevin Smith and all the indie filmmakers. So my sort of love of classic movies, and then friends introduced me to like the 70s movies and all the kind of cool Godfather and all that stuff.
Chinatown.
Yeah, Chinatown and Tax Drive. Yeah, all that stuff. So I was sort of, my love of movies was continuing. And then the 90s hit, and then that was our era of all those young, great independent filmmakers. So I was already starting to really fall in love with all that and reading, you know, Filmmaker Magazine and finding out what was playing at Sundance and all that shit. So when I went to Purdue, I was kind of just doing what you do after college, where you go to college. And journalism was on my mind. My dad was for the first 5 years of his career was a broadcast, was an anchorman, actually. He actually looked exactly like Ron Burgundy. He was very much a 70s anchorman. It was hilarious. And then my uncle was a journalist. I had journalism in me, which I loved and still love journalism. So I was thinking of doing that. But I was really itching. I visited my sister in LA, fell in love with it. And very shortly after, you know, getting into Purdue, I knew I wanted to move out to LA. So I moved out to LA. I went to Indiana University just for a few months the following year, but I lived with friends and didn't go to any class except maybe my film classes, and then moved out to LA '96. I think. Yeah.
Wow. Wait, so now I got to ask you this, because I think that we're unique. I had the same experience, which was, you know, I had been living a bunch of places and not really spending any time in LA, and I came out to LA for a visit and fell in love with it. What was it for you about LA, about Southern California or whatever that attracted you so much? Do you remember?
I fell in love with as well immediately. I think it was the big city. I think I was hankering for a big city, that it was the film and television capital. I definitely, probably to a fault, romanticized the industry, which is really fascinating what we've kind of learned the last 5 years on how flawed and how, and especially during that time, it was an incredibly flawed way we were doing a lot of things with the sort of tyrannical swimming with sharks kind of producer mentality that was going on and all that stuff. But that said, there's a lot of beautiful things and wonderful things about this industry. And I think we're probably in the best place it's ever been in terms of, the good people, working with each other. So, but I definitely romanticized the industry. I loved the big city. It was very affordable. As big cities go, compared to New York and San Francisco and even Chicago, LA was the affordable place. Now, this sadly, very sadly, changed in 2008 or so with the housing crisis. And now we're in a real housing crisis here and a rental crisis now. But at the time, it was affordable. So it was very doable. I was half full of ambition and little small town guy in a big city, and also really scared that I couldn't do it. And so LA was a good thing because A, that where I wanted to be, what I wanted to do was here, but also it felt more affordable and like a big suburb rather than a big city at first to me. So what did you fall in love with? You were from the South, from Georgia or Alabama?
I was from Georgia. I mean, I had traveled around. I had spent some time in the Midwest and the Northeast. And I mean, I had a friend who was living in the Westwood adjacent area. And there was just, I don't know, there was something wholly unique to me about, I remember a coffee bean. I was like,
oh, yeah, coffee bean was huge in the 90s. Yeah.
What is this magical place where you can get freezy coffee drinks all day long and sit outside in this gorgeous weather with the students walking around and all these beautiful people? I don't know. It was fully romanticized to me, but I remember just being like, oh yeah, this, I could do this. And it's true what you say, actually. Like, I don't know that it was cheap, but you could get so much more for the money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, in New York, you would be in a tiny, tiny studio apartment in a seventh floor walk up. And you might spend the same amount of money, but you would have, you know, a full bedroom and a balcony. You could be outside or a little yard even and sort of room. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you moved now, you know, you say you romanticized the industry. Were you thinking you were going to get into film and television at this point?
That
or were
was
you
the
just
plan.
More moving? That was the plan.
Okay. Well, movies.
As a writer, director.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the plan, the very unformed, very green plan, and the plan that ultimately and unsurprisingly did not work was that I was simply going to work in a video store, write a script, and get discovered. I mean, that I don't know why that didn't just work out. That seemed to be what everyone was doing at the time, and I guess I just missed that boat. Now, I was, you know, committed to working hard and learning. And I made a short film, I remember, with on film, not on digital. This is before, right, as digital was coming in. So I like spent money on like at 16 millimeter, I guess, short ends, which is like where you would buy like what people didn't use on their movie, their short ends of their film. And I made like a nice little movie and spent everything I had and went broke doing it, like a short film. Did all the things that I thought I should be doing. But I was just too young and too undeveloped to really navigate that world with any real expertise. You know, I just wasn't really ready. I'd come out sort of too soon, probably, and a little bit unpolished. So the plan was very much to get into writing and directing. And so, yeah, I kind of pivoted to acting 4 or 5 years in when I was like at an acting class that I'd kind of taken as a quote unquote as a director. I think I was like, well, now I should learn how actors work since I'll be working with them so much, you know.
Now, and this is Ivana Chubbuck, is that right?
You are very good, Ryan. Yes.
I mean, look, I try as
You're
best I can.
Succeeding.
Yes, and she is a very big acting director at the time. It felt like everybody was taking classes from
her. Yeah, she was, yeah. And I'd gone through all the levels kind of that she had a couple lower levels that you take first. Then I kind of graduated under hers.
Okay.
And loved it. And saw kind of a path. I really needed to be sort of jostled out of my poor
plan. And acting gave me like a vision, like a road in front of me that I saw, which was very simple. I mean, the one thing I had going for me was I was very patient. Like you probably know, as friends sort of start to be like, oh, maybe this isn't for me, or the industry starts to, you know, take its toll on you early yes. on. For whatever reason, I was like pretty much in it for the long haul. I had no plan B, but I was also like comfortable, like taking my time with it, like being a starving artist for a certain degree in my 20s and wanting to actually get good at it. And I just need a commercial agent. I remember just being like, all I need is a commercial agent. I didn't even want to get a commercial yet. I was like, have an agent. And then after that, that agent will maybe hopefully get me an audition. And I just remember being very clear. Like I think now looking back, I was very relieved that I finally had like a plan that I could at least succeed or fail at. Whereas before that, I was kind of flailing. And so I was like, okay, well, this is a plan. It's really, I've seen other people do this plan, and we'll see if I can navigate this road. And if I don't, then I'll have a little better sense that I've tried and not been able to.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because I don't think I've talked to anybody about that. I want your opinion. What do you think it is that made you stick with it when so many don't, right? I mean, because that is there is a huge group of people who come out to do exactly the same thing you did, or let's just say they think that they're going to be actors, and then it just doesn't happen. Do you feel like it's worth it? Work ethic or stick-to-itiveness?
I mean, I know I'm thinking of one in particular, a friend that I came up with and was very good and worked just as hard as anyone and had the talent to at the very least have a solid career, but also had like a really good plan B if it didn't work okay. out, or just had a skill set. I shouldn't say that. Yeah. I don't think he was relying on his plan B, frankly, because he had to kind of go back and really like go to school and kind of actually make a hard choice to sort of pivot. But he had a skill set. And I think in that instance, I think he just was looking at the rest of his 20s and looking at his life getting started the way he wanted and knew like, okay, yeah, there's a chance this could happen. You're also looking at a road ahead of you and you're seeing a lot of different examples. You're seeing people that have like maybe held on too long. You're seeing people that like hit right away and you're kind of suspicious of that. You're like, well, I don't want to think that that's going to happen to me. So somewhere where maybe I'm in the middle, maybe I'll start having a career. And it becomes very practical, right? And you know, I'm sure you know this. The dream aspect of it goes away. And the idea that yes. you just want a sustainable career is really what 95, 97% of us are. I mean, the wonderful stars out there who are able to pick their own projects and kind of design their own careers and make an amazing living at it, or who are really comfortable being bohemian, like, I don't know, I'll work whenever I want to, and I don't need to make any money at it, and I'll live on a, there's like that. The rest of us are like, well, at some point, yeah, I came out here with all this passion and dream of what I want, but I'm good at this, but now I need to like build a career. And if I have a family, I need to be able to, you know, so I think you start to put that together. And when you are doing that in your mid to late 20s, you start to make decisions for yourself. And it's literally different for everybody. And it's, you know, Jack Lemmon used to say this, and I'm sure you and I are probably perfect examples to say the same thing. Plenty of people I came up with that were better than me, that continue to be better than me, that worked harder, that came from a better theatrical background, and other people that weren't. That thank God they figured out a way to get out, because they were never going to. They either didn't have the talent, the work ethic, or they had stars in their eyes in the wrong way. So it kind of is all types. And I think I do think some of it was a desperation. I had really no backup, but I was feeling confident enough. I think at the earliest part of my career, I was feeling confident enough. I was getting, and it really is because I was getting a lot of commercial work. And once that I started to see that people were responding to what I was doing in that format, I was like, okay, I just knew, okay, step by step, now let me see if I can get some TV work and stuff and small TV work and each thing. But I had plenty of crises, plenty of personal crises in my late 20s and early 30s before I was able to have a sustained career of like, if I hold on too long and I don't get something that sort of gets me to the next level, this is going to get scary for me. This is psychologically and financially and every way else. You know?
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Well, Kyle is being modest. There was a period of time that Kyle was on television more than Ellen DeGeneres. Commercials galore, Geico, Staples, Coors Light, T-Mobile, Stanley. Yeah. He played a mission control in a man's bowels.
Yep, where I improvised the line, Code Brown. Yeah.
Oh, you did.
Very basic, but very, you know, I committed to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, were you at this time, would you get recognized on the street for your commercials? You must have.
I think so. I think there was a couple that, you know, would play very nationally. The T-Mobile one was the one that actually that other people saw and got me a big TV thing at right after that. But
okay,
yeah, I think there was an article done very, very randomly. An Entertainment Weekly did an article called the 30-Second Man about this very thing. Like okay. That guy, yeah, that was really, I was going through a bunch of mementos the other day and saw the article, which was really fun to see. But yeah, no, very fortunate and very to the point of like, I had seen a plan for myself. One thing I did during that time is I worked at a commercial casting studio. So I don't know if you remember 200 South La Brea.
Of course.
It was the hub, literally central in the city. And you had 8 or 9 casting directors working at this place. You would see everyone in town there every day. You and I probably saw each other before we knew each other. And yes. I worked there. So when you would sort of work for the cast directors and there was a job that you were right for, they say, oh, Kyle, come in on this Pepsi thing or whatever. So you just were around it all day and exposed. So I remember that was a big key to me sort of like staying in the game, you know, in a really smart way, like just to sort of be around it all the time.
Does 200 South La Brea still exist?
I don't. Well, I think it does actually. And whether they may have moved. There's a great cast director that cast me in so many of those named Ross Lacey. And I think he,
I remember ran, Ross Lacey.
Yeah. Yeah. And he might've moved it or sold it or, but he was excellent and really instrumental. If you're listening, Ross, thank you for my career. But yeah.
200 South La Brea. For those of you listening, you have to understand this. It's the craziest thing. And this is like, there's no parking, very little parking, impossible to park. And you would enter the building up a tiny stairwell. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And you would go up this tiny stairwell. And as you're going up this like two flights of stairs, you would pass 17 actors that you knew kind of. And then you would get to the top. And there were, well, you probably know better than me, but like, eight or nine rooms off of a giant bullpen.
Yeah. The huge bullpen area. Yeah.
Huge area, like almost warehousian.
80 actors, either 80 to 100 actors or two. It was like either like you and two other people, because at the end of the day, or there were 80 just aspiring everythings. Yeah.
Yes, and waiting to go into one room. And like, so Imodium was one room, Pepsi was another room, T-Mobile was another. And you and they would be inside. And the thing, the thing that you, there were no chairs. What there were was,
of course not.
There were carpeted blocks. Right?
Yeah.
Like huge, like huge areas that were carpeted that you would just sort of like, kind of sit on, I guess.
Yeah. And very uncomfortably. Yeah.
Elbow to elbow with everybody else, everybody running their little lines.
They would, you would, it's that surreal thing where it's like you were a type. And so you would go and you would see a bunch of yous there. You would just see, I would see a bunch of Kyles there, you know, either new Kyles I'd never seen or other Kyles that like, hey, what's up, Brad? Like we always see each other at these. I mean, you know, and you'd have your, this is the headshot days. I'm like, you would have your headshot. Probably when I started, black and white headshot. So I remember the big switch to color. So, and then when you, that little hallway, you would see an actor in a hurry or an actor that just was pissed off about their audition or an actor who felt good or with an actor who had the greatest attitude always, like he's always in a good mood, you know, he'll be fine. You know, like you would see every type of actor coming down that those stairs.
Yes. That, no, it's totally true. Or for me, I think always like parking semi-legally. And it was just like, I just needed to get back out to my car as quickly as possible. So just like, hi, how's it going?
You probably had the club at the time. I remember having the club on the steering wheel, which locked the steering wheel. Did I put the club on as your, so many. And, you know, lovely people that would work there, but also overworked people. And so, you know, you didn't always get the most polite room in commercial. You know, casting is normally a very warm, polite rooms in most instances, but because of the speed of it and because you're working with like 800 different clients in those rooms, they could be rough rooms in terms of how you felt as an actor. You could get shuffled in there and kind of feel a little like mistreated, and this was part of the thing. It wasn't like a horrible mistreatment, but it was just like, if there's one aspect of casting that had that, it was the commercial and even shooting commercials sometimes. Everything else, you're pretty well taken care of, especially with cast. And I always tell actors that who are nervous about auditions, it's like, they want you to do well. They want you to be the answer to their problem. They want you to come in and surprise them or be exactly what they're looking, you know, so they're rooting for you. Every room you go into is rooting for you. They don't want an awkward experience either. They want their answers solved. And so,
Yeah. But to your point in terms of commercial, I've never really thought about this before, but I think when you're dealing with brands, you're dealing with at times, you know, the executives, and they're not artists. So they're not looking to take care of you. And I remember palpably feeling like you would enter the threshold of the room from this, you know, there's 80 to 100 people bustling around. Your name would be called. You would walk through the threshold. And at times they would look at you and then just immediately look down.
Yeah,
like you are clearly not the look that they want.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't matter what you say or do, because it's all about this look that they're looking for. And then you have to kind of continue for the next few minutes knowing this is just not happening.
Yeah.
This is not happening.
And that your car might be getting towed. Yeah.
Exactly. Early on, you break out of doing commercials, you start doing some guest star roles. And my research has indicated one of the first scripted shows that you did, not the first, but one of, was a little television show called The Office.
I'd have to look into that and see. What was it called again? The Office. Yeah.
The Office. Talk to me about the audition for that. Had you met Allison Jones before, or was that new? Was this, did this had anything to do with the commercial stuff? Because this was a local ad where Michael tries to create a local ad and you're ad man.
Let's go to a clip, Johnny. Yeah. It is a brilliant. And I'm sure your fans, the minute you said the local ad episode, they know exactly what you're talking about because it's hilarious. And that was so fun. And that the show was, that's season three?
Four, yeah. Episode nine of season nine four.
Of so. Season four. And Jason, who had just directed.
Jason Reitman?
Jason Reitman. And he had just directed Juno. And Juno was not out yet, but it was getting like festival love and stuff. And I remember him like jokingly putting Juno stickers all over the set. Because he was like, yeah, yeah. So Allison Jones is, and you know this, completely responsible for so many people's careers. My, you know, one of the handful of cast directors that are just like my guardian angels in this business and who I constantly, you know, just thanking because she, now it's interesting. Was that what year is that? 2007? 2005?
No, this would have been 09 probably.
Okay.
08, 09.
She might have just been starting to get me because around that time she cast me in a few things. And then since then, like I said, has been just a great booster in my career. So wonderful. So this might have been one of the first things with her. One thing I did around that time is I did this thing called Real Pros. Do you remember Real Pros or any of those casting workshops?
I don't.
They had a somewhat of a controversial moment because there was considered paying for auditioning. Mm. And so... But it was like a workshop, and then and once a week or so they'd bring casting directors in, and you could actually audition for them in this workshop in this class. I was doing that a lot around that time, and I actually got a few little things from that. I don't think Allison was, so I actually don't remember the audition process. Doubt very highly it was like an offer, so I must have auditioned for it. And I remember the striking thing about that was like, oh, you guys, like most of the cast stays in on all scenes, so like. Actors always kind of like, oh, I'm not in this scene. Great, I get to go. But in the office, they're like, no, you guys need to be in the background. And do you remember that scene by any chance? Or that episode, if you would have been back in that? Because we might have met that day. You guys were all so friendly.
Yes, I'm sure that we did. I do remember I went back and looked at some of the stuff in preparation for talking to you. But it was a crazy thing because, yeah, like you said, we were all there almost all the time. So unless... You know, you had some characters who went to a restaurant or, yeah. You know, did something else. We were all sort of there. Do you have any memories of being there or of Steve?
It was one of those things, yeah, where this happens sometimes. And I'm sure in the office, you guys had this all the time. You kind of get the best seat because there's so much observing in that show. So much time where you're just sort of like, you're like, okay, this person gets to do their thing now. And I'm literally just reacting. And Steve... I just remember being in the presence of I was already a fan of his, and where I just got to sit across from him. I just fed him a couple lines, and he got to, you know, he had the scripted version, and you know, he'd get that. And then once that was gotten, he was like, go off on his own. And the whole bit is that he keeps building this ridiculous commercial idea. So it's really like a comedian's dream. Like, all right, give me a couple takes where I just get to build the most ridiculous, you know, ambition for this local commercial. So I just remember being charmed by that. I was very humble and quiet. You know, you're being a guest star or co-star in those things. You really, I don't want to step on anyone's toes. So I just sort of was like a fly on the wall, but also like, you're always pinching yourself in this business that you're getting to do it. So it was like, I hope I'm prepared enough to do what I got to do and also kind of enjoy it while I'm doing it. And this is really exciting. And so I just remember kind of just sort of enjoying getting to watch him work was the best. And also great professionalism by all of you and just like camaraderie. I remember that couple of you guys, and I'm not sure if you were playing like fantasy football. I think it was like Dwight and Jim were like, but in real life, they were like in between takes.
Yeah.
They were like looking at their fantasy scores together. And I just saw like real sweet friendship and friendliness. And it was just neat.
Yeah. We just recorded for this our Super Bowl episode where we had our commissioner on, and we just finished our 18th year.
Oh, wow.
Doing the office fantasy football league. So
that's so great.
Yeah. At those times we might've still been drafting on a yellow legal pad, but,
maybe. Yeah. 2009. Yeah, right? I do remember them looking down, or maybe he was using a laptop. Yeah. I don't think we had a smartphone quite yet.
No, not quite. You mentioned before you kind of get a big break here. You get cast as the lead in Worst Week for CBS. And this was because of a commercial you were in? Is this how this started?
Yeah, I mean, that was like a big, long process. I auditioned with a bunch of people. And then the project was shelved for a year or something. And in the meantime, the great Jay Tarsis, the creator of several shows, I think including the Mary Tyler Moore Show, was the father of Matt Tarsis, another brilliant mind in this business, who is a show creator and TV writer. And Jay told his son, hey, have you seen this commercial? This is like probably the energy you're looking for Worst Week. And Matt was like, I think I've seen that kid. I think he might have come in last spring. So they brought me in again. And thankfully, I did the whole process of coming in a couple of times, then testing in front of the CBS executives, and probably read 3 or 4 times to get it. But without that phone call and without that commercial, I wouldn't have had that chance, which was extraordinary. And CBS wasn't really doing the single camera comedies at the time. So this was their big swing with single camera comedies. And lovely, amazing experience all around with it. And just really was happy. And Matt Tarsis is amazing. And yeah, it was great. Got to work with Kurtwood Smith, who I'm still friends with now. And it was great.
It was based on a British show, which this is 2008. The Office is taking off. And I wondered about that. Like, is CBS taking a run at single camera British adapted shows?
Well, yeah, you know, I think you're exactly right. Yeah, I think there was a lot of that going on. And looking back, you're right. I hadn't really pieced it all together. But there was there was definitely that. And they weren't really, they had all their multicam stuff working really well for them. So ultimately, we got to shoot, I think, 18 episodes. And they aired, I think, 14 of them or so, which for me was, I remember a lot of people being, you know, feeling really bad for me, like when we kind of had the feeling that it was going to get canceled. And I was like, when you're coming up in LA, every single small step is like a huge deal that you are proud of yourself for.
Right.
You know, like that, you know, I got into audition for a pilot. That's huge. Oh, the pilot is actually good. I got a part in the pilot. That's good. Oh, your pilot didn't go to series. I'll did the next one, you know, but I'm in the game, you know. It's like, so I remember being sad that I wasn't going to get to work with Aaron Hayes and Matt and Kurtwood and Nancy and all, you know. Fred Willard played my dad in that show. I mean, I couldn't, there was That's no awesome. World where there was anything bad about, you know, yeah, it's sad to lose it, but like I got to have Fred Willard play my dad, you know, and he actually looks like my dad in real life. So it's just sort of like.
Who looks like Ron Burgundy.
Yeah. He looks like Ron Burgundy and Fred Rowdy. Yeah. You're like, Kyle, your dad looks like too many people. he also, weirdly, and you're talking about Steve, he kind of looks like Steve Martin too. Actually, there's a, right behind me, is a picture of my dad from his days back in the, in South Bend, WSBT News.
There you go.
But I mean, it was just, you know, getting a big show is life changing, you know.
Do you feel like that gave you confidence moving forward? I mean, having that experience of doing that same role every day, 16, 18 weeks or whatever it was.
It did. It gave me a couple of different things with that. It taught me both good and bad about my own approach to that stuff. I really wore myself out with it. And I had a very specific way that I wanted to like do the physical comedy. And it was my first time like being that big on a show or being like the lead of a show. And I think I put a lot of pressure on myself. I had fun. I didn't feel like stressed out or nervous. I was like, I had fun, but I was like very like, did we get that? And should we do another one? I have another, you know, I didn't understand TV. I didn't understand that, you know, these directors had a shot list they needed to get through, you know, for some, I thought like somebody that came from like wanting to be a director, I would be much more understanding about that. But I was like, can we do 12 more takes, please? Cause I think I think I was very right. much like, and I was like, I didn't get it. I slipped, but it looked like I knew I was going to slip. I want to make it more surprising when I slip, whatever. So I was very kind of demanding of myself and then ignorant of the process. So I feel like if I went back in time, I would just be a little more like, oh, everyone has a job to do here and I need to make sure that I'm not like stepping on toes. So I think I just learned how to be a little bit of a better professional. And that came also from working with people and watching them. Kurtwood Smith was excellent at just sort of being a great model for how to conduct yourself. And it probably took me a few years to learn how to like get what I wanted to get across in earlier takes, you know, quicker, especially for television, so that I didn't feel like I left anything out there and I didn't feel like I was slowing anything down, because you never want to be the person that's slowing anything down. I always like tell people, like, kind of learn early on what everyone has to do on set and stuff so that you kind of understand how the whole production works as a whole. So I think just that learning experience was key. And then knowing that, yeah, just taught you like what you need to get ready. Like, oh, if I'm going to do this kind of joke, this is the kind of preparation I need for it. So yeah, such a learning experience.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You have guest starred on an incredible number of what I'm just going to call today, to make it simple, Hall of Fame shows. So we're going to play a new game, Games with Kyle. This is going to be first thing that comes to mind when you think of your time working on the following shows. Are you okay? Ready?
Yeah.
This is called First Thing That Comes to Mind / Hall of Fame with Kyle. Here we go.
Great.
How I Met Your Mother.
Hybrid, no live audience. So that was the big thing with that. Is most sitcoms always had live audience, and they invented this, they didn't invent it, but they really did, where you didn't always have a live audience. And I remember loving that because I get very nervous with live audiences. And I still, it's funny, I don't remember the lines right now, but it was something about pregnancy. And I remember sitting there on that couch doing that bit. Also same thing, very proud and excited. I had a job and like, not wanting to screw it up.
Breaking Bad.
Ugh, the greatest thing in the world. He is amazing. So when you talk about like a model for professionalism,
yes,
he is the exact model. This is their first season. It wasn't big. No one knew that this was going to be the iconic show it was. But he got a gift for me. Like the minute I walked in my trailer, he was just so accommodating to everyone. He was just so lovely with everyone. The whole set was doing like something, I think, because it was
we're talking about Bryan Cranston, right?
Bryan Cranston, sorry. Yeah.
He bought you a gift?
Yeah, he gets everybody that comes on that set a gift, like a really nice welcome gift, and maybe even a goodbye gift. And I don't think I was there for more than 2 days. And so he just very, I know, now you feel bad, don't you? Like now I'm like, shit, I don't know if I've gotten enough gifts for people. I don't know. And even family members, I don't know if I've gotten enough gifts for. And this guy's getting, and he's just so present to everybody while doing these amazing, like, okay, action. And then he has to do this guttural, deep, emotional performance, and it's not like he like snaps out of it right away. He just
he knows how to, like, he's just kind and wonderful professional. He's one of my best models I ever saw for, like, how to conduct yourself. So that's what I remember. And then just also, it was the writer's strike. So I think they were finishing production, like, the day I was leaving, because they had the writer's strike. So I think that first season had less episodes than the other ones. And I just remember looking back, being like, oh, no one knew at this time. Everyone had confidence in the show, and it looked great. I mean, it was really fun. And everyone, like, had knew it was good material, but no one knew it was going to become, you know, one of the greatest shows of all time.
That is insane. Mm-hmm. That is insane. I'm going to share with you a story. I don't know that I've shared this story. If I have, listeners, then go back. I don't think I have. I was invited to join the Television Academy, and I was like, well, I'm in the Academy now, and I need to do my part. And I remember that year for the Emmys, I signed up to be a special judge on basically everything that I could. So, like, I think I wasn't allowed to do anything for comedy. That was it. Oh, okay. So it was like best actor in a drama, best supporting actor in a drama, best guest star in a drama. By the way, what this means is you have to watch a tremendous number of hours of television.
And you guys are then put the pool together that then is made into nominations?
No, so I think what it is we were given 10. So the membership at whole had sort of gone down to 10.
Okay.
And what I knew was this. What I knew was I had never heard of Breaking Bad, and I knew that there was a huge percentage of the membership that had never heard of Breaking Bad. So to get down to that 10, I wasn't sure how Bryan Cranston at that moment had gotten to be one of those 10, just because when you're in the Academy and you vote, you just vote for what you know. I had not heard of this show, and I was studied television. So I got the 10 tapes, and I mean, tremendous performances from those days, all of them. And then you had to rank them 1 through 10. And they used that in combination with the larger Academy to decide who wins the Emmy. And I watched those 10 tapes. And for those of you listening right now, we're not talking to Brian, but that performance in the pilot, it was the pilot, was so unbelievably amazing. I mean, yeah. I was blown away. I hadn't heard of the show. I hadn't seen the show. I went immediately and found all of the episodes to watch at that moment. And he won the Emmy that year. Wow. Because for not just one, did I put him one, everybody who was in that pool had to have put him one, because there could not have been enough people. Like, in other words, as a member, I hadn't voted for him because I hadn't seen the show. I didn't know. Anyway, I will never forget watching that performance for the first time and seeing that, and the fact that he was so kind and nice. He directed on The Office as well, and got to know him a little bit. But that's amazing. This is not turned into the rapid fire game that I intended. But anyway,
that was my fault. I tend to give very long-winded and on just no impact answers. Give me one more. I'm gonna try to give a quick answer.
Well, no, don't do that, because then.
Were you gonna do Will and Grace?
Will and Grace.
I ended up in Eric's lighting 3 takes in a row, and he was very polite and just sort of politely asking me to get out of his light.
I love that. All right, a couple more. Westworld.
Western. If you ever get a chance to do a Western, do it. It's the greatest thing in the world. You get to clunk around in boots and the dust kicks up in your face and you feel like you're literally back in time. I loved it. Also season 1, which we had no idea what we were doing.
Right.
That it was going to be amazing.
I liked that show, season 1, a lot. Yeah. Modern Family.
Oh, well, yeah. Giggling all the time because it's just everyone in it is so funny. And the concept was funny, which is that Jesse thinks he flirted with me when we were teenagers. And he thought that I was straight and he thought he was being too, like, forward with me. And he wanted to apologize. And I'm like, oh, no, I was gay. Like, I just wasn't into you. And every time that part, it was just a great concept. And also, I just remember that you guys probably got in this late in the office. They shot like 8-9 hour days, which is, if there's anyone out there, like, that is unheard of in this business, but which should be more normal, at least a, you know, 9-10 hour day rather than 12-13 hour.
Okay, last one. Better Call Saul, revisiting 8 years by my math after Breaking Bad.
Yeah, Better Call Saul. That was another great one where I got a view for the second time. I did Better Call Saul, or was it the first time? I forget. I'm at a bar and I just get to watch.
Odenkirk do his thing. He had like a big monologue, I think. And it's just another thing where I like, and then I have to come in and say like two lines for this first scene. I just remember being like, man, Better Call Saul had already been kind of a legendary show. Breaking Bad had already been a legendary show. So now I'm just on this like legendary set. I think they had won the Emmy the year before. Okay. And he gave like a speech to the crew, like really nice speech to the crew. And I just sort of remember pinching myself and feeling fortunate to be back on that. And then in the ADR session where they needed it, like the after the, I'll have you explain ADR. I remember them. They were like, you just be an asshole, like off camera. I want him to like be reacting to you being an asshole. And I just remember like they said, say the worst and most awful things you can say. And so I just remember doing that, sitting in a sound booth in North Hollywood, just coming up with the, Vince had written a few awful things for me to say. And just like, I don't know if I hope or don't hope that somewhere is still out there.
I guess a couple more, but these are more discussions. Arrested Development, you played the character Shannon Ryan. That's your wife's name.
That's my wife's name.
Did you just choose it?
No. Wes's name, the creator of the show. Oh, my names are escaping me today. When you edit this, go back, just put his name in my face right away. It's funny because my boys have been watching Arrested Development lately. So they were friends. So my wife worked together. She's an executive now at Disney. At the time when they were doing Arrested, she was an executive on that show, and she was friends with him. And he thought it would be funny to call me Shannon Ryan, to call me her name.
Okay, last one. We've got to dive into this. I've got to understand BoJack Horseman. Now, you weren't in this. You have not appeared in this to my knowledge, but your name is. I need to understand how this happens.
Well, yeah, you have it there. Yeah.
This basic, I have to say the line to let people know.
Yeah.
The line is Pickles about dinner tonight. Am I any network with a show starring Kyle Bornheimer? Because I have to cancel. Now, what? Do you know these guys? How did this start? And why are there so many inside jokes about you in show? What happened? Is this flattering? I don't understand.
It is. Remember earlier when I said, hey, I'm just happy to be here. What's the best way to answer? Listen, that is a great joke, first of all. Objectively, that is a killer joke. And yes, there was a time when I would get cast. And frankly, listen, I work hard. I think I do well what I do. I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely, at least for a long time, in the network side of network comedies, but definitely known for, like, my shows would only be on for a year or half a year, sometimes four episodes. Again, I do go back to, like, I'm just happy to be here. And I, you know, as long as my career can keep going, you know, there's no guarantees you're going to get on some big long lasting show. And I know that, but that probably sounds like I'm trying to, like, you know, not tell people how hurt I am by it. But I don't know. I feel like I have a pretty zen perspective on it. And I just know how hard it is. Yeah. So I don't know. The main takeaway is that is a very funny and well-crafted joke. And so I'm happy to be a part of it.
Well, I mean, look, I was like, what in the hell is this? And then I was not sure that we were going to discuss it today, but after our conversation, I felt like it was a conversation we could have. Do you know Arnett or do you know any of those guys?
I do. One of my earliest jobs, they would never remember, but was Blades of Glory when I had a quick little scene with them. Yeah. That was my first movie, I think, ever. I had one line, which is, "It's you're up" or something like that. Okay. Our kids actually now go to school together. I don't think I know. There might be one writer on that staff, I think, that or at that time that might have known me. I almost hope it wasn't, though. I hope it was like so known that just like, yeah, you know, I just saw a trailer for a show with Kyle Bornheimer. What's the bet that this is going to go 6 episodes, 20? <you know? laughs> I love most of the shows. I did one show during that period that was Worst Week has had a great like little cult following afterwards.
Yes.
But I also did this show Perfect Couples, which was lovely, and I had a wonderful time, which was a really neat experience. I mean, you know, like I've never had a bad experience in this. If you're working in this industry, you know, and you have, you know, halfway decent attitude about it, you're usually having a good time, because at the very least you're working with really either nice, kind people or incredibly talented people, usually both. And you're sometimes legends. You know, I could be on a bad show that I'm suddenly like working with some legend, and I'm just thrilled.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Teddy Wells,
yeah,
with my old buddy, creator Mike Schur. How did you get involved with that show? Did you know Mike?
We are kind of neighbors, and our boys are really good friends, and we're sort of family friends with Mike and JJ. And at the time, I don't think we knew each other very well, if at all. That was probably starting with, and I can't remember if that was an audition or an offer, mm-hmm. but either way, it was perfect for me. That was right in my wheelhouse of just like a goofy, overly sort of boring dude, you know, probably typecast. that one was very easy from the perspective of I kind of knew exactly what I wanted to do, and it was written in a way that, you know, that show is written so well. Like they have the secret sauce in that show. Also works very quick, and I remember. Great group of people, like you guys, just a great group of people. And, you know, it's only Mike, and this was in The Office, and this was in Parks and Rec. And I've heard this talked about a little bit. They kind of ushered in the, what sometimes is called like non-conflict comedy, which is like, we grew up in very conflicty comedy. And that seemed to be the rule. Like you had to have two opposite roommates that were always arguing, or you had to have like the asshole at the office that was like saying sexist shit to the secretary. You know, there was always like, and I think we just, with the onset of like the late 90s, early 2000 comedies, there was like a different way into comedy. And I think that's what, like this community of funny people where funny things happen. It's not like because that sort of conflict comedy doesn't work, but it just like a new style. And I think he ushered that in. And I think it also just created, I think, this amazing camaraderie with those big casts of 8, 9, 12 people that those shows had.
Wow, that is such an interesting point that I have not thought about that before.
Yeah, but you're like observational, right, or what you would call
it. Yeah,
it,
like, but it's also like more character based, you know, and you may have idiosyncrasies, is a polite way to say it, or, you know, specific character traits that might be oppositional in a way. But like, yeah, if you think about, you know, Dwight or Ron Swanson or those characters that, yeah, it's not like totally oppositional in a way. It's much more ensemble, specific characters who are interacting together. And quite frankly, most of the time there's a genuine basis of love.
Yeah.
And ensemble togetherness that's sort of is behind all of it. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that quality, yeah, it's hard to sort of like put my finger on it, but it definitely was a switch and just a new color to television comedy that was sort of celebrated and fostered in that time. And I think Mike was instrumental in that, and Greg and all those guys, yeah.
Yeah. You've been very busy lately. Avenue 5, your interstellar comedy alongside Hugh Lowry, mm-hmm. and my old buddy Zach Woods. Aww. Fun show to be a part of.
Crazy fun and crazy. And Zach is, as you know, one of the great comedic minds and just minds in general. I mean, that guy's mind is, he's another one where we all just sit like, okay, Zach, it's just, you know, it's the camera's on Zach and like, what's he going to do? And yeah, we're in a spaceship the whole time. This crazy, humongous spaceship with a working elevator. And, you know, Armando Iannucci just sort of composing and conducting this complete chaos with these really subtle sort of social commentary underneath that. All of us about the fourth episode, we're like, oh wait, he's talking about Brexit. Like we were all like, oh, this is like just, this is, you know, we didn't even understand. Like one of the great satirists of our time was like doing a satire again. We're like, oh, this is his like funny, goofy space comedy. He's like, oh no, he's talking about how like the rise of tyranny in some of the major nations of the world right now. So like we actually had, you know, got to dig deep, and living in London was beautiful. And Jessica St. Clair, who's a great friend of mine, a husband and wife for like the 13th time on screen. We just love playing off each other. And Hugh Laurie is exactly the amazing, sophisticated Brit that you think he is, and drives a motorcycle. And we're all kind of in awe of him. Every single person has a crush on Hugh Laurie. so yeah, incredible.
Also, High School out now. Were you a Tegan and Sarah fan?
Marginally. I've since become much more, but I knew like about five of their bigger songs, Walking with a Ghost and a couple of their hits and the Lego song I knew about and knew them and always see them like on festival posters when I was looking at festivals. So, but really thrilled to sort of dive deeper into their work, which is incredibly rewarding. Like they've had, I think, 10 or 12 albums in the last 20 years. And so they have a library of songs. It's really good. So that was fun. And getting to know them and reading that book about them, that experience was great. Clea Duvall and Laura Cottrell, who created the show. That's, I'm sort of rambling now just because I can't think of any other words besides fantastic and awesome, but it's the 90s, it's set in the 90s. I love the 90s. I kind of considered myself an expert on the 90s and sort of like that indie flavor of the 90s, indie movies, indie music. I was kind of that kid. And this sort of mines that world, that part of the 90s, but from a perspective that I was so ignorant of, like embarrassingly so. Two girls, you know, coming of age and coming out and discovering music for themselves and in a still pretty close-minded 90s, even though we kind of considered 90s the beginning of sort of modern progressive attitudes about these things. It was still pretty close-minded. So sort of seeing that the 90s from that perspective compared to the perspective I had was eye-opening. And I'm so glad I got to get that in my life.
That's awesome. Kyle, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your story. I'm a big fan of yours. I'll watch you do basically anything, not everything, no, but basically everything. And I appreciate you coming and taking some time with me today. And I found you have opened my eyes in a new way. I'm super, super fascinated by this idea. I'm going to be thinking about it later today, this idea of the shift in comedy and the paradigm that those guys changed. That's very interesting.
And you're a delight. And I'm not even going to just say, hey, anytime, please have me back.
All right.
After I've had a few more canceled shows under my belt. And
yes, I will for sure. Thank you, Kyle.
Of course. This was great. Thank you so much.
Kyle, it's so good to see you again. Thank you for stopping by. I cannot wait to check out your new show, High School. And to those of you out there listening, thank you as well. I'm going to see you next week with another guest with office roots. Deep, deep office roots. Until then, why don't you go out there and for yourselves and for me, just have a fantastic week. All right. We'll see you soon. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Sammy Katz. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Brett.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or a ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today. Health Aid kombucha.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and
process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox